Imagine holding the keys to an economic engine that pumps like 14.6 billion rand into your country's economy every single year. And yet, it only takes up maybe 1.7% of your land.
Wow, yeah.
Right. That is the actual reality of South Africa's forests. But there is a massive catch here. Like 70% of the people living right next to that high-value engine are, well, they're living in severe poverty.
Which is just a staggering contradiction when you think about it.
Exactly. So today we're doing a deep dive into a 2004 policy document from the South African Department of Water Affairs and Forestry. It's basically trying to solve this exact contradiction through something called participatory forest management, or PFM.
And you know, what's fascinating here is reading this not as your standard environmental playbook, but as a hardcore socioeconomic strategy.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the state realized that keeping fences up around these 2 million hectares simply was not working. So they proposed a massive transfer of power, taking forest management out of state hands.
Wait, transferring those rights directly to the local communities?
Exactly. The previously disadvantaged local communities take on the physical responsibilities and the rights directly.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because giving up state control over what amounts to, I think it's like 4.1% of their total export earnings, that is a huge gamble.
It is a massive gamble, yeah.
So why make that structural shift in the first place?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the state recognized a pretty grim reality. Like, when people need fuel, wood to cook, or timber to build a shelter just to survive the week, a government conservation sign means absolutely nothing.
Right, you can't eat a sign.
Exactly. The degradation of the forest was a direct symptom of local poverty. The policy explicitly argues that unless the surrounding populations actively and legally benefit from the forests, well, their basic survival needs will completely strip the resource base.
So it's essentially shifting the model from treating locals as trespassers to making them shareholders. Like, if you own stock in the company, you don't burn down the warehouse for warmth.
That is a perfect way to put it.
You protect the asset because it pays your daily dividend.
Right, and that dividend is the whole crux of the PFM structure. But to actually distribute it without crashing the timber economy, the government had to introduce mechanisms to legally bridge the gap.
Like what kind of mechanisms?
Things like forest enterprise development and community forestry agreements.
Okay, I struggle to see how this works in practice, though. Handing over legal ownership of a multi-billion rand industry to decentralized rural communities, I mean, that can't be as simple as just signing a piece of paper.
Oh, definitely not.
So what does a community forestry agreement actually do mechanically?
You can think of it as a highly regulated commercial lease. It legally forms a local community into a recognized corporate entity.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and that entity is then granted exclusive rights to harvest specific amounts of timber or non-timber forest products, but only if they adhere to strictly monitored sustainability quotas.
So it allows them to legally sell what they previously might have had to poach.
Exactly. It brings them into the formal economy.
But here is where it gets really interesting, at least to me. Establishing a formal corporate entity in a rural area, negotiating land leases, setting up compliance monitoring, all of that requires heavy government bureaucracy.
Oh, absolutely. Tons of it.
Doesn't that take years to implement? If the forests are already degrading because people need to heat their homes tonight, how does a 5-year bureaucratic rollout stop a tree from being cut down tomorrow?
Well, the short answer is it often doesn't, and the document itself actually warns about this exact vulnerability.
Wait, really? They knew it was an issue.
Yeah, the data from their early rollout showed that communities enter these agreements with incredibly high expectations for immediate, tangible income.
Which makes sense.
Right, but when the process inevitably stalls in bureaucratic limbo, like waiting on land surveys or local committee approvals, that initial community buy-in just collapses.
Because long-term conservation promises simply don't put food on the table today.
Precisely. And when the money doesn't materialize, that enthusiasm quickly turns into withdrawal or even outright conflict.
Man, that's tough.
The policy makes it starkly clear, actually. If the economic benefits aren't quantified and felt in the short term, the entire conservation framework fails. People revert to survival mode, and the degradation accelerates.
So what does this all mean when we step back?
Well, it changes everything we assume about conservation.
I mean, it completely flips the traditional conservation model on its head. You simply cannot separate the trees from the people.
No, you really can't.
True environmental sustainability is mechanically impossible without immediate, tangible economic empowerment for the people living inside that environment.
This raises an important question to consider when looking at environmental efforts globally. If localized, immediate economic survival is the absolute prerequisite for keeping a forest standing in South Africa, how should that change the way we design, fund, and judge modern climate change policies in our own backyards today?